Welcome to the Mattcast. You're listening to a podcast that at least attempts to bring the church world and the art world closer together. My name is Matt Anderson, and I'm glad you can join us on this podcast, whether it's your first time or your 20th. Well, today I want to talk to you about an aspect of art that often gets ignored, but I think is so necessary toward preserving many of the great works that we see today. Specifically, I'm talking about art restoration. And perhaps you've seen the work of art restorers who are able to, for instance, on paintings, they can remove layers of corrosion or smoke or other damage that has been done to a painting over the decades or even centuries. And they're able to bring back the original colors and the intentions of the artist. It's a very valuable work that's done. But I'm not going to speak about a painting so much today as I am a home. Specifically, I want to talk about the Boynton House. The Boynton House in Rochester, New York. It was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, who many regard as America's greatest architect, or at least one of. Now, the house was called the Boynton House because the original owners were the Boynton family. And the patriarch of the family worked for a corporation there in the city and was very successful. And so they commissioned a house. And I think he had seen the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. He was not as famous yet. And wanted him to design his new home. And so Wright designed a 5,500-square-foot home, which in the early 1900s was pretty monstrous. 5,500 square feet, but it also included a tennis court, a fountain, and other features that would occupy a one-acre lot. And he designed this according to his sort of well-known prairie style of architecture. And he loved what he called organic architecture, which means that the house almost seemed to rise up out of the earth. It was so in line with what was happening in its surroundings. So it was much lower than many of the colonial homes that were around it. But it was magnificent in its modern design, especially for its day. It involved tons of natural light, gorgeous handcrafted furniture. He even designed the landscaping that would surround the home. Frank Lloyd Wright left nothing to chance. And like anything he designed, it was incredible and unique. And all of his homes looked like they belonged to the earth around it. But as the house changed hands, it was originally built in 1908, and as the house changed hands over the years and as it aged, some of the subsequent owners made what you could call modifications to the home over the years. And so once 100 years had passed, it wasn't quite the house that it once was, as you could imagine. So in 2009... the house is now just over 100 years old. The house was bought by a man named Fran Constantino and his wife, Jane Parker. They bought the house for $830,000. That's a pretty heavy price tag for a 100-year-old home, but considering who designed it, that's what most of the price is. Now, when Fran and Jane bought the house, Jane wanted to move in immediately. She wanted to enjoy living in a Frank Lloyd Wright designed home. But Fran thought it might be best before they moved in to do a thorough inspection of the home and then determine what next steps should be. Well, as many of you home buyers and homeowners know, only after the inspection did they realize what they were truly in for. Because of the unique structure of the house, the harsh winters of northern New York, and just general disrepair, it had caused the house to lose its former glory. And so at this point, Fran and Jane had a decision to make. They could decide to just not move in, hang on to the house, and maybe flip it or sell it for a profit. Secondly, they could just move in as is and deal with whatever lumps they were going to take as homeowners. That's what previous owners had done. Or they could make the decision to restore the home before moving in. Now, the third option was clearly the hardest, it would be the longest, and it would be the most expensive. But that's what they chose. Now, if you've ever been a part of a remodel of your home, we're not even talking a full restoration, just remodeling your home, you know how invasive it is to your life. It becomes the center point of everything you do, and for a substantial period of time. But I guarantee you it was nothing compared to this, because the restoration of the Boynton house would utilize more than 150 individuals. It would take 2.5 years to complete, and it would cost over $2 million. But what rests on East Boulevard in Rochester today is the exact home that Frank Lloyd Wright designed. It has been restored to its original intent and design. And by the way, this is not a museum. It was not set up this way so that people could walk in and take tours. This is a private residence. Jane and Fran live there year-round, and they use it as it was also intended by the architect. He wanted it to be lived in, not just looked at. And sometimes, maybe in our lives creatively, we might have the opportunity to restore something artistically. Whether, again, that is a painting or whether it is a home, or maybe you're doing a reboot of a play and you're going to do a modern version of classic literature, whatever it is. Often the restorer does not get the press or the credit like the original designer does. But it really is their artistry that preserves what was originally designed and created for future generations. I think it is a skill that benefits humanity, and people who do that don't get near enough credit that they deserve. But I want to take this to a spiritual plane for a moment and then expand it in our next section, because when we look at our lives, I think there's a wonderful parallel with the Boynton house, because of our sin and our selfishness, we are diminished and flawed human beings. God made us in his image, but we were born into sin, and further decisions and attitudes and motives in our life have only brought more decay. We have done harm to ourselves, and we've done harm to other people. In fact, we sold ourselves to the worst owner of all, who cared nothing about our corrosion, our erosion, or our destruction. In fact, his stated goal is to steal, kill, and destroy. But I want you to know that you and I have been bought and paid for by a new owner, even in our wrecked, some would say condemned, condition. We have been bought and paid for by a new owner. Sin and destruction and the enemy, they used to be our owner, and we did whatever it beckoned us to do. Our life was in disrepair, and in many ways, we looked beyond hope. But because of an act of supreme love by Jesus Christ, we are under new ownership. Jesus has the keys to our life. He has the deed. And rather than focus on what we lack, the Lord looks at us, and he doesn't just sit on that as it is. He doesn't just say, well, at least we saved it from being torn down. He sees potential in us. In fact, he is all about restoration. You know, I think about a verse like Ephesians 2:10. We are God's masterpiece. He has created us anew in Christ Jesus, so we can do the good things he planned for us long ago. He still sees us as his work of art. And there is that magnificent moment when you and I believe and recognize that we have been bought with the price of the blood of Christ, and we are justified because of what he has done, not because of us. And if you have not made that decision, I pray you will, because it's the greatest decision you'll ever make. But even still, that doesn't mean we don't have damage done to us. We all do. Like the house, it took a while to get into this condition. And yes, we know that we're now bound for heaven, but restoration is going to take a while. Our God is a God of process. Yes, he does do miracles. Yes, he can instantly change our lives and heal, and he does. But most of the time, he works through process. He could have created the earth in milliseconds and everything in it, if we believe God is who we say he is. But he chose a process. He chose a process of 6 days to gradually make everything that we see and hear and experience. And what I'm trying to say is that if we're looking for restoration in our life, because we all have damage that's been done to us by others and mostly ourselves, and if we want to be restored, it's going to take a process. It's looking around the house and saying, wow, this may be more than just a wave of the hand. This might be 2.5 years, 150 people, $2 million expensive. I want to tell you that process is worth it. It's going to take more than one church service or more than one podcast, that's for sure. That doesn't fix us. It's going to take a process. And the question is, are we up for it? Many Christians will not commit to this. But if we're in, so is Jesus. Restoration is a process, and it is not pretty. But it's what he desires. And when we come back to him, and we give him a chance to just start that wonderful process of sanctifying us, we'll talk about that in a moment, we realize that he's the one who's not just the designer, but the driver of our restoration. When we come back in a moment, I want to talk about what this process looks like and whether we're willing to get closer back to our original design in order to live and act the way our designer intended. Wow, folks, I am so glad you can join us today. You're in for a real treat. I am fortunate to be able to interview really one of the most famous people in America right now. Unfortunately, it's probably for all the wrong reasons due to the spread of COVID-19. And there obviously continue to be questions regarding the virus and how best to battle against it. So I thought we would hear it straight from the mouth of America's leading authority on the subject. Very fortunate to have him join the podcast today, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Dr. Fauci, thanks for being on the MattCast.
Well, thank you kindly. It's great to be here. Which camera am I looking into?
There's no camera, doctor. This is an audio podcast.
Really? No camera? And I actually agreed to do this?
Well, somebody did. Dr. Fauci, we continue to hear almost dueling statistics on a daily basis. At the time of this interview, much of the media is reporting that cases are going up at an alarming rate. However, others are saying that the numbers of hospitalizations and death are decreasing. So how should we interpret those numbers?
Well, it is true that the numbers are certainly fluctuating.
Right. I just said that. But what takeaways do you have from the recent data?
Well, to me, it seems that the number of cases is increasing at a rapid pace, which is certainly alarming, but not unexpected. It's certainly something that I predicted, so I'm not surprised by this at all. However, I wouldn't have been surprised had the numbers gone down either, because that is something I predicted a few weeks ago. I find these numbers are quite alarming.
Right. So what I recall from a few months ago was a refrain we heard from everyone at the highest levels. They were telling us that we needed to flatten the curve. In other words, do what we can to not overwhelm our healthcare system and then create possible shortfalls in healthcare. Now, Americans were quite accommodating in doing that.
No. Look, I'm sorry here, but whatever your name is, but I have been trying to put that rumor to rest for some time now.
Rumor?
Yes, a rumor. Everyone thought I was saying that we needed to flatten the curve when what I actually was saying is that we needed to fatten the curve.
Fatten the curve?
You heard me right. Fatten the curve. Our hospital beds need patients. We need elective procedures to come back. We need plastic surgeries, Botox injections, chemical peels. Hollywood, where are you? Please, fatten the curve for us. In fact, I'm calling all hypochondriacs across America to be unleashed to come to your local ERs and urgent care centers with every phantom illness you can imagine. This is the only way we can truly fatten the curve and combat this virus.
So we need to fatten.
Yes, fatten.
The curve.
You heard me. Fatten the curve. I think I've been very clear about this issue from the beginning.
I see. That says a lot. So there seems to be a lot of debate about masks and whether they really help to prevent the spread of the virus. I mean, early on, I seem to recall that you really didn't believe they were effective, but during the last month or so, you seem to have changed your mind on that subject. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, I believe I've been very consistent on this issue, random interviewer. I believe that whatever we can do to prohibit the spread of this virus is something that needs to be pursued. This is why you'll notice that I am now always wearing a mask while on camera. I think it's important that I set the right example as a healthcare professional to give the appearance that I am wearing one, because clearly the mask works, except when it clearly doesn't, which is most of the time.
So should I wear a mask or should I not wear a mask?
Absolutely.
Uh-huh. So I know our time is limited, and you probably have another engagement to get to soon here.
Oh, definitely. I've got a call in. I'm hoping to be on Dancing with the Stars this fall.
With or without the mask? I'm just kidding. So obviously, the greatest concern is with those that have passed away from the illness. By the time this pandemic is over, Doctor, what is your educated guess as far as a final figure on how many will have perished from this disease?
Well, for obvious reasons, I really try not to speculate on many things.
Really?
But from the models I have studied and the calculations I have done, I would put the figure to be somewhere between 1 and 8 billion.
Okay, so that's basically the Earth's population. Would you care to maybe nail that down a bit?
Would it be okay to use the word bajillion?
No, not really.
How about ginormous?
I don't think so.
Oh. Well, I'd better leave it at that then, because I don't like to
speculate on many things. Right, got it. Well, Dr. Fauci, thanks for your time and for spending it on what's essentially a startup podcast with a very small audience.
Yeah, I'll have to talk to my agent about that. Well, good day.
He knows he's not getting paid for this, right? Restoration is a process. It is not something we do ourselves, because that's how we got into trouble to begin with. Paul talks to a group of Christians who are making that mistake in Galatians chapter 3. He writes, "Let me put this question to you. How did your new life begin? Was it by working your heads off to please God, or was it by responding to God's message to you? Are you going to continue this craziness? For only crazy people would think they could complete by their own efforts what was begun by God. If you weren't smart enough or strong enough to begin it, how do you suppose you could perfect it?" Now watch this next phrase. "Did you go through this whole painful learning process for nothing?" I want to read that question again. "Did you go through this whole painful learning process for nothing? It is not yet a total loss," Paul writes, "but it certainly will be if you keep this up." See, we didn't get saved on our own, and we don't continue on the path of Christ on our own. I'm not saying we don't play a role, but we're not the ones driving this and leading this. Jesus guides our sanctification. That's that wonderful $5 word that talks about the fact that he instantly has set us free and set us apart from our old life. But then there is a continual sanctification that slowly but surely makes us more like him throughout the years. That process of being restored. So let me talk about this work of restoration that I think the Lord desires to do in us. And I want to use that question from Galatians chapter 3, because every one of those words, I think, describes the process. He talks about going through this whole painful learning process. So the first thing I want you to know about this process is that it's a complete process. He uses the word whole, W-H-O-L-E, this whole painful learning process. Now, I mentioned that Fran and Jane, before they moved in, decided to do a thorough inspection of the home. And yeah, while the outer edifice still looked rather nice, maybe needed a fresh coat of paint, there is certainly more to a home than that. And only when they inspected the home did they find many of the glaring problems inside. For instance, one of the supporting beams upstairs that was supposed to really hold up the roof, I believe he wanted the beam to be 8x10. That's what Frank Lloyd Wright spec'd. But instead they put in like an 8x6 or something smaller than that. And so the roof eventually began to sag. Consequently, the home also began to leak. Support beams that were in the basement originally had been removed in order to get more space, which caused the house to sag even more. This brought the wood in the lower part of the house now in contact with the ground and moisture, which can become an open invitation to termites and carpenter ants. And yes, those had infested the internal wood of the lower half of the home. Many of the wood pieces near the surface of the house were pretty much as strong as lettuce and would just easily flake off from human contact. The upper floors would have flooding issues, as mentioned before. The septic tank was often backed up. Here's what I'm trying to say. So often we look at the outward things. We look at the very obvious things. It's like buying a car and just kicking the tires. We deal with the bad behavior or the addictions, the obvious stuff. But we never do the inspection of looking beneath the surface of why we do what we do. You see, we got to get to that internal wood. We have to get underneath and see where all the insect and bug life is found. This is really where restoration kicks into gear. But it's also a place that few people want to go. The Lord wants to take us on that journey. He wants to do a whole process. He doesn't just want to work on the obvious outside stuff. He wants us to get underneath at what occurred in our life that makes us do what we do. Secondly, I would say that this is a painful process. Again, Paul says this whole painful learning process. And folks, no way around it. This is not feel-good gospel stuff, but it is gospel stuff. It may not feel good, but this is gospel. And I'm not going to hide it. It is painful to change. Ask anyone in recovery. I wish I had come up with this line, but it's one of my favorites. Change occurs when the pain of change, and changing is painful. Change occurs when the pain of change becomes less than the pain of staying the same. How painful will it have to get for us before we adopt new strategies, before we just start to say, this isn't working? How bad is it going to have to get before we finally take on the pain of change? I was in a parking lot one time. I had just come out of a clothing store and was unlocking my car door. And I looked at the car next to mine in the parking lot. And I don't know how to describe this. I have never seen so much trash in one vehicle in my life. The back seat was completely unusable. And I'm telling you, it's like fast food bags and cups and straws and napkins and all kinds of odds and ends. And it was piled, I'm not kidding you, to the ceiling of the vehicle. The front passenger seat was almost completely full to that level. And I had to reflect on it when I got into my vehicle. I thought, how long is that going to go before the owner of the car says, I can't do this anymore? How high up does the trash have to pile up before we go through the painful process of emptying out the junk and getting rid of what's been around for so long? The third thing about this process, and last, is that it's a learning process. He says this whole painful learning process. See, the Lord wants us to learn some things in this process so that we don't go back to the behaviors and the thinking patterns that got us into the messes that we've been in. This is all part of his restoration. He wants to teach us. He wants to give us tools to keep us from going back to where we were. And maybe that's going to be through your pastor, a psychologist, a counselor, someone external to us who can mirror back to us what is dysfunctional. See, a lot of us, we've learned to survive, but we haven't learned how to live. And we've confused the two. Some of us have grown up in really awful situations, and we had to learn to adapt in order to survive. And we just figured that's the way you live, but it's not. The Lord wants us to learn new skills. He wants to show us not just how to survive. He wants to show us how to live. See, just because something is familiar to us doesn't mean it's right. That's what took me a long time to realize, that the tactics I had adopted to survive as a kid were not going to work because I wasn't living. I was still barely surviving. You see, the thing to remember is that the designer is here to engineer this whole process. It's not us white-knuckling it and using our willpower to make it happen. We have the architect with us to be the power we do not possess on our own. He has this remarkable way of tapping us on the shoulder at different points in our life and saying, okay, are you ready for this to go? I pray we'll always say yes to that because he wants to restore us. Just like a damaged home or a diminished painting, it's not going to be easy, but he is in the restoration business. So get started on the process today. Well, we want to thank you for being a part of the Madcast today. Our music is by Sound of Fusion. We hope to see you again soon. This has been a production of Monumental Ministries. For more information, for our books and resources, go to mattministry.com. Hey, thanks for having me over. I had a wonderful time.